Welcome to Author Stories, the podcast where we talk to the best writers in the industry and discuss writing and the creative process. Whether you are a writer, a reader, or both, we hope you'll find something here that makes you love books and the writers that create them. You can find archives of all of the great conversations I've had with authors over the years at hankgarner.com. Take some time and browse around there. I'm sure you'll find a new author to love, find inspiration for your own creative life, and find a new story to get lost in. Let's thank some sponsors who make the show possible. We're so happy to have our friend Crystal Pico Watanabe as a sponsor of the show. Crystal is one of the best editors in the business, and she has just debuted a new service that I think you'll absolutely love and will help you to up your writing game. Pico's School of Wordcraft and Editing has just debuted, and the first course is called Properly Punctuating Dialogue. It's a mini course and can be completed in just about 20 minutes. It covers the basics of dialogue punctuation. Authors can get access to the new school and the course for free by signing up for Crystal's author newsletter, Notes from Pico. Go to picoshouse.com/newsletters. That's PIKKOSHOUSE.com/newsletters. More in-depth courses will be added in 2020. Make sure you don't miss a thing. PicosHouse.com/newsletters. Unwilling Souls by Gregory D. Little. Books 1 and 2 are only 99 cents for a limited time. The gods are rightfully imprisoned, and Cess intends to keep them that way. But her terrorist father has other plans. Gregory D. Little's Unwilling Souls is a pulse-pounding chase through an epic fantasy world of adventure, sinister conspiracy, and a magical industrial revolution fueled by harvested human souls. Cess is the daughter of powerful parents who would very much like to kill one another and who therefore pretend she doesn't exist. An apprentice jailer of the gods, Cess spends her days learning to forge the tools needed to maintain the gods' prison. When her terrorist father attacks the prison on her 16th birthday, Cess is forced to flee after the secret of her parentage is revealed. Suddenly on the wrong side of the law, Cess realizes the very father who abandoned her may be the only one who can protect her. But some secrets are darker than parentage. On her way to find her father, Cess will uncover truths about her family and herself that will shatter her understanding of the world and risk the return of the gods themselves. Unwilling Souls and its sequel, Ungrateful God, are on sale now for only 99 cents. The third book of the series is coming early next year, so now is the perfect time to get up to speed. Unwilling Souls by Gregory D. Little. Books 1 and 2, only 99 cents for a limited time. Writers, I have an amazing tool to tell you about. A revolutionary writing tool for planning stories, Campfire Pro is what novelists need to go from the seed of an idea to a detailed plan that's ready to be executed. Complete your character design, create a timeline, and track your world building all in one place with our downloadable desktop app for Mac and PC. Without the annoying subscription model so many apps are using today, visit campfiretechnology.com for special holiday pricing on Campfire Pro today. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I am super excited to have my friend Justin Long on the show with me today. You might know him as Justin B. Long. You might also know him as J. Boyd Long. Both fantastic writers, actually the same guy, but writing a little different stuff under each of those names. And we're going to talk all about it today. Welcome to the show, Justin.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Man, I'm excited to have you, Justin. I've been a fan of your writing for a while, and I'm happy that we finally got to connect here on the podcast. As you know, we begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
I think for me, it was in high school. I took a creative writing class, and I think at that point, it was the first time it ever really occurred to me that I could create my own narrative where I'm the hero and I can control the outcome, which was, you know, wildly opposed to my life at the time where I felt like I was the victim, you know?
Oh, me and you both.
I wrote two stories basically in high school. I had One of them, my best friend and I ride off into the sunset on Harley Davidsons, and the other one, my best friend and I ride off into the sunset on horses. But they were both escape stories, basically. So I was trying to change my narrative.
Lots of sunset.
Right.
Yeah. I hear you. Were you a bookish kid, Justin?
Absolutely.
Yeah. What kind of things did you love?
Man, I started off super early. My parents didn't believe in television, so I was reading story records when I was 3 or 4. I think that's kind of how I learned how to read. And, you know, that got me into a lot of Disney stuff, but also into like Lord of the Rings and things like that. They had the short versions of them back then. But I was, I moved on into like Encyclopedia Brown and then the Bobbsey Twins and then the Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew and that kind of stuff, you know, very early on. And I loved it. You know, I loved the friendship between those people and the adventures that they went on, and just it was my escape. You know, I was really not happy with my life as a kid, and I didn't like my home life. I had a lot of problems with my parents, and reading was my door to get out of that world. So I read everything in the library, I think, by the time I was in high school.
Yeah, man, those story records, like audiobooks before audiobooks were cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They were great.
I loved them. I loved them so much. There was I was trying to remember, there was a Disney, The Black Hole. I remember having that one and having the book that went with it and just wearing grooves in that record over and over and over again.
Yep.
So much fun. Yeah, and I think a lot of our influences are the same. I remember I had every Encyclopedia Brown book, and my favorite time of year was the Scholastic Book Fair at school, where I could see if there was a new Encyclopedia Brown book. And between Encyclopedia Brown and superhero comics, I think that's where you know, kind of informed the rest of my life. Yep. Oh man, when did you start? You talked about writing those two stories, you know, with you and your friend riding off on Harleys and horses. Were those the first things that you remember writing for yourself?
I think so. I didn't really have any confidence as a kid, and I also didn't have a lot of direction from people. So it never really occurred to me for a long time that books were written by real people. So, you know, I didn't have that in mind, that was something that I could even consider. So I just thought I was along for the ride for everybody else's.
It's so weird when, because I've talked to a lot of people who had that same kind of experience, you know, that you think when you go to the library or the bookstore that these things just kind of magically appear from whoever the guy is that brings in boxes of books, you know.
Right.
You who knows where they come from. And then one day, you know, books become something that you can do, and that's transformative.
It really is. I was writing a lot of short stories in my 20s. And even then at that point, I didn't have a lot of instruction with it. So I didn't understand structure of story and things like that, but I really enjoyed the creative process, and I worked out a lot of my demons that way. It was kind of a therapeutic process of, you know, getting even with people I felt that had wronged me and all that sort of juvenile stuff that you go through.
So, Well, writing those short stories in your 20s, were you writing them, kind of, what was your end product motivation? And by that, did you have a purpose for those stories? Were you writing them just for your own enjoyment? Did you want to sell those? Did you even think about that there was a market for those?
I was on writing.com, which was, I think, one of the early writing websites. And so I had my little portfolio on there where I could share those stories with other people. And I tell you what, I craved that feedback when somebody would read my story and review it, even if it's just a little one line, you know, enjoyed this, this is fun, you know, give it 3.5 stars or whatever. You know, I knew they weren't great, but just getting that feedback from somebody else that tells me that I created something and it wasn't a complete waste of their time, that's really what I was going for, I think.
Well, and you know, sometimes that early writing motivation, just knowing that someone is reading your stuff, can have more effect on a writer than someone even giving detailed critiques, because sometimes the biggest thing that stands in our way is the confidence to think that, you know, we deserve to be sitting here doing what we're doing. And sometimes just the feedback of someone that says, I enjoyed that story, that's more than you need, than you know of.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we all just want to be accepted by somebody else, right? Some basic psychology. You know, I hate that I fit into the same mold that everybody else fits into, but I think when you really get down to it, I just wanted people to accept me.
You're like, dadgummit, I'm just like everybody else.
Yeah. But I want to be different.
Right. Tell me where your love of science fiction comes from.
Oh, man. I don't even know if there's a source on that. That's one of the book series that I was into young that I failed to mention was like Tom Swift and Tom Swift Jr. And I couldn't even tell you what those were about at this point. I just remember I loved the futuristic just tech stuff that was involved in all that, you know, it later on getting into Isaac Asimov and things like that. I read a lot of science fiction, but I was really a Stephen King fan more than anything most of my life. And I always wanted to find that magic junction where, you know, Stephen King's prolific giant, you know, 2000 page books could, you know, meet up with somebody that's writing, you know, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Cause I always wanted that to be such a longer story cause it's so fantastic. You know, it was far too short for my satisfaction, but I don't know. I did a lot of cross genre reading, but I've always kind of leaned in towards the more speculative fiction stuff. It speaks to me more because it's different. I think it's an escape from the mundane.
Yeah. Well, I was listening to some Harlan Ellison videos a while back while I'm doing my daily stuff. I usually have something on in the background I'm listening to, and there was some seminar or something that Harlan Ellison was doing, and he was talking about how he hated being branded a science fiction author. And and he said that because, especially back in the 60s and 70s, if you got branded that, then people put you in a very narrow bucket, and they thought they knew everything there was to know about you if you wrote science fiction. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, some of those umbrella terms have really broadened, you know, in the last few decades. But I understand what he was saying. And I kind of feel like Stephen King is in that same conundrum sometimes, because I think a lot of times he gets labeled a horror writer. And for sure, some of the stuff he writes is horror, but a whole lot of it is not. It's just kind of, you know, he's more of a fantasist, if you will. And, you know, it leans into speculative fiction, leans into sci-fi, leans into fantasy, leans into horror, all of this kind of stuff. And, you know, they, and I kind of, you know, and that's great for him. Everybody, you buy a Stephen King book because it's a Stephen King book. But for a lot of authors, they feel like they need to really be narrowly tied to a specific genre. And you talked about, you know, reading widely. And I love the idea that authors can write widely and just kind of take the cuffs off and just, you know, let your weird go where it's going to go.
Definitely. You know, Stephen King understands people, I think, in a way that no one else does, and can communicate who a person is so completely. I think that's just something I've really appreciated about his writing style. And, you know, I think you're completely right that I don't consider him a horror writer at all. You know, I would consider.
But a lot of people do.
I know he's always been tagged that, and I agree that it's probably sort of an unfair title for what he does. It's so much more than that. It's not just, you know, slash and chainsaw stuff at all. So
right. Well, unfair is he's going to the bank and cashing checks, but you know, we can
right exactly.
We can weigh out unfair, but yeah, I know what you're saying. Oh man, so. So after high school, what do you decide your life path is going to be?
Oh man, I had so many plans. So I joined the National Guard when I was a junior in high school, and I went to basic training the summer between my junior year and my senior year of high school. And my whole life plan, I was going to do 20 years in the military and retire at 37, and I didn't really plan it out past that, but that was kind of my goal. And so after I graduated high school and I went off to advanced training where I learned how to drive bulldozers and all that kind of stuff, because I was in an engineering unit, I was going to transfer into the regular army. But by the time I got done with that second set of training blocks, I realized that the Army was a horrible place for me to be, because I went into it thinking that I had a problem with my dad, and I found out that I have a problem with authority.
Your dad just happened to be the authority that was in the way.
Yep. Man, I tell you, the Army is a great place to find out if that's your situation or not. So I found that out, and that kind of changed everything. But then I was lost. I didn't know what to do with myself. And I was kind of recovering from my childhood, and I just drifted aimlessly most of the time. I think I had good jobs and they were stable, but it was nothing that I was passionate about, no career or anything. And I was miserable in my life. I was drinking heavily, and I was writing all these short stories, just trying to capture that escape from my childhood of the books, you know, and it didn't get me where I wanted to go at all. And, it wasn't until I met the woman who is now my wife that I actually got some direction together. And I was 38 when that happened. And everything changed for me at that point. I'd been sober, I think, 5 or 6 years when I met her. And so I'd been started getting myself together. But as far as finding the life direction and actually getting into serious writing, it took me a long time to get there.
And your wife was the horse doctor.
Yes. Yep. She is. And that's another thing I think is it's sad, but it's funny at the same time, is how far short we sell ourselves on what we're capable of achieving. You know, if I had at 25, if I had ever, you know, been told that I was going to marry a doctor and be a semi-successful writer, I wouldn't believe it, you know, because I thought that stuff was so far above me. I didn't have any of that confidence that you need to get anywhere in life. And so, you know, a couple of wonderful therapists helped me get to the point where, you know, I do believe that I'm deserving of the same things that everybody else is deserving of, and that I'm capable of doing things. And that was the most wonderful gift that anybody ever gave me. It's letting me know that I can do that stuff too.
Absolutely. I've talked to a lot of people that, that writing has been a bit of that therapy as well. And, you know, sometimes, well, if you take a group of 100 people and you ask those 100 people, you know, how many of you think you have a story in you, you know, almost all the hands are going to go up. Everybody, you know, at some point thinks that they have a story that they could tell, and rightfully so. Now, you know, say that you give them a year to do that, come back after a year, maybe 5 of those people, maybe 20 of those people have tried, maybe 5 finish, and then, you know, out of that, you know, one may actually go on to do something with it. It's just such a, it's such a narrowing experience. But at the same time, if you're one of those people that get from beginning to end, that is a transformative thing. Just knowing that you could finish something and you can create something out of thin air and it's completely your creation, and you followed through with it, is an empowering thing on its own.
Oh, unbelievably so. And it took me several books to really get there, because the first one might have been a fluke. So I was still nervous going into the second one, you know. But then I did the second one, and I was like, man, this is for real. And the confidence that I had when I wrote my third book was unbelievably different. And it's just such a freeing feeling, you know, just not having that anchor hanging around your neck, that anchor of doubt. It is a wonderful transformative process.
Right. So tell me about your series, the Dim World series. Where did the idea for this world come from?
I think it's like all of my ideas. They come to me in the shower out of the mist, and I don't really know what the source is. I do all my best thinking in the shower. But
nor do we question it.
Right.
Just to let it come.
I think it's the one place where I cannot possibly write something down, even if I wanted to. So that's my brain screwing me over. But the Genesis Dimension, or the Dim World series, is kind of it's a story about me, but it's not a story about me. It's more about trying to put into words what I think is wrong with the world, and then going through that writing process of, you know, writing that out, and then trying to find solutions. It's really a journey for me on just coming to terms with how I view the world and how I would fix it if I had the ability to do so. And so I went into it not really knowing what those answers are going to be. And just as my characters keep finding themselves in stranger and stranger positions, you know, I have to sit down and figure out, okay, I painted myself into a corner. How do we get out of this? If I'm in that situation, what's the real answer? So I created this universe where there's multiple dimensions of reality, and they all have a shared history up to a certain point. And then a major turning point in history, like, you know, Columbus landing in the Bahamas. In our reality, we understand what happened because that's our history. But in the new dimension that was formed, you know, his ships were burned, his crew was killed, and the whole colonization process of the Americas was very different, right?
Right.
And so we have this whole new world now where that's happened. And so trying to figure out, you know, if the whole colonization thing, which has had such a tremendous impact on every corner of the world, if that didn't happen here, how would things have developed? You know, how would the Native Americans of North and South America have continued to evolve in their societies and cultures? And how would the rest of the world have continued to evolve if they weren't spreading out to the Americas? So just that journey alone, I think, was my starting point. That was where I decided if I'm going to write this book, this is going to be my first alternate dimension and try to figure out, you know, what would have happened. And I didn't really come up with clear answers to that because it's so complicated. It helped me understand just how interconnected everything in history is. And so that side of it was tough.
Well, and when you start, looking at your own life, there's a story in our family, where, my wife and I had two sons, and we were my kids' generation is the first generation in eight generations where there's been more than one son in the Garner family.
Oh, wow.
So if at any time, if any one of the single sons had died, that would have been the end of our family. And it's just, you start kind of unraveling all of the ways that life can go wrong, or you know, all of the ways that any situation could take a left turn, and life is just infinitely changed. That mm-hmm. that could be almost crippling when you start thinking about it.
It can, because there's so many possibilities and everything is so fragile. That's the other conclusion I came to, is that the fact that we're here is so unlikely, because any little thing, like you said, along the way could have changed everything.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy. Tell me about the character of Quentin James. So we've got kind of the world setup of all of the infinite possibilities. How does Quentin James fall into this?
So Quentin James is a low-level IT tech that works at an oil company, and he just, you know, keeps the network going and helps people reset their passwords and all the annoying things like that, that I think people get into computer programming thinking it's going to be exciting stuff. And that's what they end up doing, is resetting people's passwords because they forgot it or they lock themselves out of their computer. Right.
Right.
So, and he has no idea that there's alternate dimensions. You know, he's just like the rest of it. He's a regular guy doing a regular job that he's not very happy at. But one day he ends up having to unencrypt an email for the CEO of the company because the guy, his boss who normally does that stuff, was out. And he finds out that the company is doing way worse things than he even thought that they were. And that the, at a pipeline protest, that the oil company had a mercenary team out there that was basically driving those people away so that they could continue installing the pipeline. And they killed some people. And so Quentin got to see what came across the news. And then he got to see what came across that email to his boss and realized that, you know, what he's being told on the TV isn't necessarily what's really going on in the world. And that led him to trying to become a whistleblower for the company. But in that process, he breaks into the CEO's office. And that's when he finds this portal that goes to another dimension of reality. And opens up this whole new future for him. Him and his best friend go through this portal and discover that not only is there multiple realities, that that's this company he works for is part of a interdimensional conglomerate called DIMCOR, and they're doing all kinds of horrible things in all kinds of dimensions, all in the name of profit, and, you know, sacrificing people for money, essentially. And I think that's it's one of the core tenets that I tried to explore in this whole series is money more important than people? And I think on the surface, we would all say, no, absolutely not. People are more important than money. But in our culture, it often turns out that it's about money. You know, it has to be about money. And I think that that's a problem that I share with Quentin James. And he goes against his company and tries to stop them from taking advantage of people and wants to shut them down initially. And that's his exploration in the first book, in Genesis Dimension, is trying to figure out how do you shut down DimCore. But for us, you know, that would be like trying to shut down Amazon or, you know, some giant conglomerate, you know, like it's all great in theory, but in reality, like, that's not an easy task. You can't just go fire somebody or turn the light switch off in a room and make them go away. You know, that's a big, giant, evil beast. And so the real question becomes, how do you force them to be better than they are?
Well, you know, it's easy to think, you know, this is just a novel. You know, corporations don't really have, you know, crazy motivations like that, and you know that money is the all powerful thing, and it's easy to think, oh, that's only in the fiction world, and then you start, you know, looking at, you know, insurance companies and things like that. And you say, you see that they already have, you know, rates worked out for a person that dies in a car crash is worth this amount of money, or, you know, this injury is worth this amount of money, and that's all they're going to pay. And this is what they have deemed that this is the value they place on that. And then you start realizing pretty quickly that this is not a fictional world that you're talking about. Yeah, this is, you know, the portal travel and all of that is a great device, but you're really highlighting what's already going on in our world.
It's everywhere. The more you look at it, the deeper you dig, you know, it's overwhelming. I married into a veterinary clinic, and so I get to see that happen in the animal world. And I think that is an easier way for me to process how we put value on life than it is looking at people. Because, you know, when you start applying it to people, you start thinking about, you know, this is grandma or this is mom, or, you know, at some point it's going to be me that people are making these valuations on. But, you know, we look at life and say it's going to cost, you know, $400 to make this life better or to continue it. You know, do we euthanize or do we spend the $400? And, you know, with people, it's the exact same thing. It's just, you know, it's larger numbers generally, but, you know, you're 77 years old and you need a new hip. That's going to cost $20,000. Is that worthwhile if you're only going to live another 5 years, or, you know,
right?
It's a horrible system.
It is a horrible system. It really is. And, but that's why fiction is so important. So we can illustrate the absurdity of things in ways that make us wake up to it.
I would hope so. That is a goal.
Yeah. So when you wrote the Genesis Dimension, did you know that this was going to be a series? I know that the first three books are out and a fourth book is underway. Did you foresee this, the arc of this big story?
I really did. I felt, I don't know what all of the stories are going to be, but when you're dealing with an unlimited number of dimensions with different histories and different ways of being taken advantage of, I think there's a lot of room for continuing this story. And also, you know, when it's a David and Goliath fight, it's not something that's going to be an easy resolution. So I think it's going to take a while to find an end, if there ever is everyone. You know, it's a wide open field at this point. And I've got book four plotted out, and I've got some ideas kicking around for book five, but I don't know how far it's going to go.
Nice. I'm excited to hear that. What was one of the things that you've learned about writing that you've learned along the way in writing the series?
Oh man, a lot. I wrote Genesis Dimension. That was my first novel, and I didn't think that I could do it. And so I went into it totally unprepared, and then I did it. And then I started taking classes and reading craft books and learning how to write. And then I had to go back and write Genesis Dimension all over again because I did it all wrong. So my level of education throughout this writing process has been unbelievable. But it's hard to say if I learned more about the craft or if I learned more about my thoughts on my subject matter, because I've done so much thinking about this stuff. And, you know, I started out with a pretty good set of ideas, but the evolutionary process of playing this stuff out and realizing, you know, if I'm going to make this true to reality, and this is the, you know, an attempt to change a culture, you know, trying to find ways to do that realistically has been an eye-opening process for me. It makes me understand why as a people or as a species that we haven't made it any further that we have. You know, it's a tremendous undertaking to try to change the world. And there are very few people who have done it on their own. So usually those are ones who have done it for bad and not for good. So trying to change the world for good by yourself is a monumental task. And just learning what it takes to create that change, I think, has been the great journey for me.
Well, I absolutely love this series. I love the premise, and that's kind of my favorite thing. When you've got some mystery and you've got some weird technology and, you know, heroes who never asked for it, that is kind of a perfect storm for things that I love. And I love where you're going with it. But you also have this kind of, you know, 180-degree other writing life, where you've got this book, Adventures of the Horse Doctor's Husband. I love the tagline, when he wedded a veterinarian, chasing horses down the interstate wasn't in the vows. where did this book, I mean, I know the book obviously came from your life, but where did the, you know, the desire to write this and how it kind of became a story?
Oh man, that's the most fun part of this thing for me. So, you know, I do a lot of things to run the business side of the veterinary clinic. But one of the things I do is I take the money to the bank to make the deposit twice a week. And the two ladies that work at the bank love hearing about animal stories and what sort of exciting things happened over the weekend, the crazy emergencies that I went on, you know, or, you know, our donkeys breaking out and doing bad things. Like, they never get tired of that. And so
jackass.
Exactly. So I don't know. I probably told them stories for a year or two, and somebody mentioned at some point, you need to write these down. You're getting a lot of wild, crazy things happen to you. And I didn't take it seriously at first, but I got to thinking about it. And, you know, I go other places on a regular basis too, and tell the same stories to those people. And like, everybody seems to get some joy out of this. So at some point I finally decided to go ahead and try to write it out and see what I could come up with.
So how did you, I always ask memoir writers this, because I'm really fascinated by how the story becomes this kind of window into your life. And, you know, it's different from autobiography, where we're talking about, you know, I was born, you know, in a, you know, cornfield in 1943 and, you know, all of this, but we're looking at this kind of self-contained story, this moment in time. How do you decide where the story is?
That's a really tough one, especially for this book, I think. And that's the only one I have experience with as far as a memoir goes. But because of the fact that I'm writing about our clients and our patients, like, it is a super delicate thing to deal with. You've got privacy concerns and all that. So some of the best stories I can't even tell, because there's no way to anonymize it enough to make it where I can put it out there without airing out people's business. So, but for me, it was trying to find an intersection of really exciting situation, whether it's funny or heartbreaking or, you know, intense, whatever it is, when that meets a really strong relationship between the person and their animal and the person and their veterinarian. And I think when those things come together, there's a magic that's kind of created in that moment. And I've tried to capture that. That was my goal with most of the stories in here, is like, people who own horses have a pretty pretty strong attachment to their horses in a way that most people with other animals don't. And it's a very special relationship. So when something goes wrong, like it's like you're, you know, something happening to your kid, you know, it's a very big deal. But they're also really fragile animals. So the medicine side of it can be really interesting and really terrifying, because so many things can kill a horse that, you know, it's amazing that they've ever survived the evolutionary process.
So, right.
And if it wasn't for people, they wouldn't have. You know, the North American horse went extinct 14,000 years ago, and having been around them for a few years now, I totally get why. they're a tough critter to keep alive and healthy. But
I had horses when I was growing up, and it was they're a huge expense. You know, and people have these. You're right. The relationship between horse owners and riders and their animals is intense. You know, a lot of us have dogs, and some of us will have, you know, kind of frou-frou designer dogs that are fairly expensive. They're nowhere as expensive as owning a horse, I tell you that.
No, I don't think anything touches the horse expense.
No.
And it's
crazy.
It's a fascinating world. You know, my wife's involved in show jumping, and like this last weekend, we did a book signing at a 3-day event down in Ocala, so where they do show jumping and dressage and cross country and jumping over these giant, massive tree falls and crazy stuff like that. And just the things that people do on horses is mind numbing. I mean, so close to death. I think that's one of the things that makes horse sports so interesting, is that the risk of life and limb for both the rider and the horse is so great at a lot of these things. It's like NASCAR, except that there's no helmets and, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's just, right. So somebody could probably die here this weekend. You know, that's right. A very different than a dog show I don't know if they have cat shows, but you know.
Yeah, probably not, because cats don't really like people and they wouldn't want to participate in that.
No, but, not at all.
Yeah. Well, yeah, as with most memoirs, there's kind of a surface story and then there's an undercurrent story. There's, you know, the kind of funny, exciting things that happen when you're chasing horses down the interstate. And then there's kind of the subtext of your personal journey throughout these. Did that kind of sub story start taking shape as you started gathering, you know, all of the exciting tales that you wanted to tell?
It did, in several different ways. I didn't expect it to be so much about my relationship with Erica, but that really ended up becoming kind of an under focus of most of the stories. And I think part of that is just because I admire her so much and her ability to handle any situation that happens. It's like I would be a complete train wreck in most of these if I was the one in charge, but just the way that she deals with people and their animals and is always calm, cool, and collected and knows what to do is just fascinating to me. So that ended up being kind of a sub theme to the book. But I also didn't really, when I started this, I don't think that I really understood the relationship that people have with their animals. And it wasn't until, or at least not on a conscious level, and it wasn't until I put all these stories together, and there were several that I wrote that didn't end up in the book, but they all had this same common theme. You know, when I sit down and I look at them, like, what are the elements of this one versus this one versus this one? And it's, you know, that relationship that people have with their animals is just a common denominator in all of them that really caught me off guard, I think. It was not my intention when I first started out with that.
When you wrote this book, I'm assuming you were already in the middle of the Dim World series writing that one?
Well, this one happened in a couple of stages. I wrote it. This is actually the very first book that I wrote.
Okay.
And I knew it needed a lot of work, but that one kind of gave me enough confidence to try the Dim World book. And so I didn't do much with it. I did some. I worked with a developmental editor on the Adventures of the Horse Doctor's Husband, and so I knew what needed to be done. I had some plans for rewriting that, but then I was excited by the fact that I actually managed to write 80,000 words, and so I shelved it and I went on to the Dim World series, and I just came back to it this last summer and finished editing it and doing all the stuff that needed to be done to kind of straighten it out. And I published it in September of this year.
Gotcha. I was going to ask you how you kind of shifted gears from one to the other, but I love that. Do you feel like that, because these are kind of two totally different, you know, ways of writing, a different genre, obviously, you know, different story mechanics. One is, you know, a thrilling, you know, fiction. The other is a, you know, personal narrative. Do you feel like kind of conquering one helped you to do the other? Or do you feel like that the writing on either of these projects was connected in some way? How do you feel like doing these two different things has affected you as a writer?
I think that they're so different. It's hard to, other than like sentence structure and some of the basic mechanics of writing, they're completely different in every way. So, you know, writing the memoir, and I'm working on the second one now, I already know the story. And I think that makes it so much easier. I know everything that happened because it really happened and I was there. And I basically just have to write it down. Whereas with the Dimworld series, there's so much more thinking involved and planning and plotting and, you know, write for a while and stop and figure out another problem that I run into. And like, there's none of that in the memoir writing. So in a way, the memoir is far easier to write, but I think it's just such a different process that I have a hard time kind of even comparing the two as far as what they have in common.
Yeah. Yeah. So you've got a second one in the works. What's the focus of that book going to be?
It's basically going to be a continuation of the first one. My working title is More Adventures of the Horse Doctor's Husband, because there's been a ton of public outcry for a follow-up. So it wasn't really planned, but I mean, I have more and more things happening every weekend. We had another one last night, so that might make it into the book. So there's just a never-ending supply of material for that. So I think as long as people are excited about it, I'm going to keep writing it.
Well, that memoir that's out now is called Adventures of the Horse Doctor's Husband, and you're listed as the writer as Justin B. Long, and then the Dimworld series, beginning with the Genesis Dimension, you're J. Boyd Long. I'm going to link both of those in the show notes of this episode, and we're going to send everybody to see you. But the two different names that you're writing under, is that just to keep genre confusion kind of out of the way? What was the – can you tell us a little bit why the choice to split those amongst two different names?
Well, because I did the – I actually published the Genesis Dimension first. I – you know, one of my many things that I do is – marketing and website design for our vet clinic. So I understand a little bit about the Google and how you need to be conscious about that. And when you Google Justin Long, you get the actor Justin Long from Dodgeball for about the first 700 pages of Google results. So I'm like, there is no way, even with what I know about, you know, maximizing my presence online, there's no way I can compete with that. He's just got way too much stuff out there. So I decided to go with my middle name. And I think for sci-fi stuff, having the first initial and the middle name is a little more genre specific for that kind of stuff anyway. So it worked out okay. But my problem with the Adventures of the Horse Doctor's Husband is that so many people know me in that world as Justin Long, and I didn't want to create confusion with the with my sci-fi readers as this being a weird sci-fi book with a horse on the cover. So I decided to just go with my regular name on that. And to be honest with you, when I published the memoir, I didn't expect more than 100 people to ever read it. So I wasn't too worried about the name recognition and getting lost in the clutter. But it took off unexpectedly. So that kind of put me in a jam, and I'm just doing the best I can with it.
Well, and thank God for those happy accidents, right?
Yeah, not complaining. Right. Not complaining.
Well, Justin, I know you as Justin, so I'm going to call you Justin. This has been so much fun talking. I'm a huge fan of all that you're doing. I have given a couple of copies of Adventures of the Horse Doctor's Husband, and I think I'm going to give more for some Christmas presents. It's such a fun book and such a it's one of those books that just makes you feel good at the end of it, and I love it. And the Dimworld series is quickly becoming one of my favorites. I can't wait to see where you're going to go with that. I'm going to put links to all your stuff in the show notes of this episode, Is there a place where people can find you online if they want to connect with you and dig into all that you do?
Absolutely. JBoydLong.com is my website. And I'm at JBoydLong on Facebook and Instagram, and you can find me easily there. And the memoir is listed under our veterinary clinic website at springhillequine.com/books.
Excellent. We're going to put a link to everything there in the show notes of this episode. Justin, thank you so much for giving us some of your time today, and we're going to send everybody to see you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. This has been great.
Thanks for tuning into Author Stories. Stay tuned for an audiobook excerpt from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane Series.
The ancient building wore the severe cassock colors of a Puritan minister, a uniform monochrome of slate-gray shingles and soot-gray clapboards, its shadowed upper windows cross-hatched like the facets of a spider's eye. The second story protruded beyond the first and bore the house's only ornament, two gray teardrops of wood, weeping from each corner of the building's stiff upper lip. The place would have looked sinister and foreboding in its shadowed alley if not for the die-cut silhouette of a dancing sheep, jaunty above the door, and the two front bay windows that blazed with colorful, welcoming light. The windows were hung with orbs of colored glass on staggered lengths of ribbon. Each orb glowed with autumnal reds and delicate greens, burgundy tints and pumpkin hues, dappled raspberry and clover lime, streaked with light and weightless as bubbles over a cauldron. The shelves below offered crystal skulls and silver daggers and horny devils, Celtic chalices and woven dream catchers in dream coat hues. A primitive broom leaned in a corner, ready for flight, and a rhapsodic nude in bronze clutched her goat-legged lover beneath a jackal bust of Anubis. The interior of the shop was even witchier. Above a crude and sooty fireplace, a stack of brick barely holding the shape of a chimney pushed through the barn-high roof, threading ancient beams that crisscrossed overhead. Brooms and kettles and Christmas lights dangled from these, alongside Halloween costumes and Chinese umbrellas, pointy hats and bundles of herbs. Jason wandered deeper into the shop. His fingers trailed across strange bronze statuary and Aztec masks of turquoise and lapis lazuli. He rolled his eyes at the luck candles and money charms, but goggled indecently at a nude and anatomically correct silver nymph with long golden hair that reminded him of Kate.
"See anything you like?"
Jason jumped, turned, and jumped again. The woman standing before him was the living embodiment of every hippy-dippy counterculture type he'd ever seen. Her hair was green, her face pale and round, her doughy body wrapped in some elaborately woven ethnic garb. Her eyebrows were black and pierced in little rows, and her eyes were heavily circled with midnight blue, as if she'd been sucker-punched by an oil slick. She tapped the glass over the nymph.
"Admiring the goddess, I see."
Oh, she'd practically caught him with porn.
"You want to hold her? She won't break. Here."
The woman flipped open a glass door and handed Jason the naked figure.
"See how heavy she is? You could bang her against the wall all day and barely make a dent."
She waggled her eyebrows, obviously enjoying his discomfort. He checked the price tag.
$700? "The goddess is a symbol of love and fertility. Don't be ashamed of desiring her."
The woman's long green fingernails plucked a long black cigarette from a long red case, and she lit it.
"I sense,"
she blew smoke and studied its whorls,
"dissatisfaction in love. Yes, I have just the thing."
She pulled Jason into a side room where the smell of her clove smoke gave way to the skunky aromas of potpourri sachets, tea leaves, and hanging clutches of twiggy flowers. She searched, found a little bundle, and pressed it into his hand.
"This will make you irresistible. Rub it on your nethers twice a day, and love shall surely find you."
Jason made a face. The bundle smelled like cow manure. He didn't even want that on his hands.